All right, well, I'm going to finish up the study on David today, Lord willing. And then I'm going to get into the epic study on problem text for sovereign grace. Next, so it won't be next week, but the week after, because next week I'll be out. So, yeah, don't come to Bible study next week, because we won't have one. So anyway, last time we looked at how David didn't restrain his eyes, right? And he got himself in all kinds of trouble with Bathsheba. And there were lifelong consequences for that for David. And this time I'd like to talk about how David didn't restrain his children. And some of these things, it's kind of almost overlapping some of the family series that we were doing in church on marriage and child training and all that kind of stuff. But anyway, I guess it's not, you're not going to hear the same thing over again, but you may hear similar things. And so I'll stir up your pure minds by way of remembrance. So David didn't restrain or discipline his children, and we'll start off with Adonijah. We're going to start there, and then we're going to go back to Absalom and then get back to Adonijah. But it says there in 1 Kings, in 1 and verse 6, and this is kind of the issue. I mean, this was the issue. It doesn't specifically say this of a couple of David's other children, but I think if you read between the lines, you can pretty much see that if he did with one, he probably treated the others likewise, and that's why a lot of these things happened to him. So it says there in 1 Kings 1 and verse 6, speaking of Adonijah, and his father had not displeased him at any time in saying, why hast thou done so? And he also was a very goodly man, and his mother bare him after Absalom. So his father never displeased him. He basically never told him no. You know, and that's, I like what Pastor Boffy used to say, that your kids, the most important vitamin that you can give them is vitamin N. Give him no. Tell him no often. But he never displeased him. So Adonijah pretty much just got away with whatever he wanted, and he did whatever he wanted. Kind of like modern-day children, usually. They kind of rule the house and do whatever they feel like, and parents run around trying to pull their hair out, wondering what to do. So fathers, your job is to displease your children often. I mean, I know you guys don't like to hear it. You two don't like to hear this. But that's father's job, is to displease you. And if he displeases you now, then you will be pleased later that he has displeased you now and stopped you from doing things that you probably think are a bright idea now, which you will find out later weren't such a bright idea. Your first job is to make them holy and then to make them happy. So that's what you want for your kids. Make them holy first. And of course, we can't do that eternally, but you get what I'm saying. So look out for their best well-being now, and then you can be their friend later. You know, you have to be their father now and their friend later. That's kind of how that works. As we talked about in the study on child training, foolishness is bound in their hearts, and they're naturally going to make the wrong decision just about every time if they're left to themselves. And I'm not just some anti-child preacher. I'm just telling you what the Bible says and what common observation says, too. In Proverbs 22 and verse 15, it says, foolishness is bound in the heart of a child, but the rod of correction shall drive it far from him. It's not found in there, it's bound, and that means that by nature your child is going to make foolish decisions, and they're naturally going to do the wrong thing. They're going to do whatever feels good, they're going to, you know, do whatever pleases them, and that's generally not what pleases God. You must be like Abraham, who commanded his children. He didn't leave them do whatever they wanted. In Genesis 18 and verse 19. And this study should be good for, you know, we have a brand new father in the church, and fathers with young children still, so this should be good information for you guys. Genesis 18, verse 19. And we have grandparents that have young grandchildren too, so you know, this can apply to a lot of us. Genesis 18 and verse 19. This is the reason why God chose Abraham, one of the reasons. This is what impressed God about Abraham. It says here in verse 19, for I know him, God says, that he will command his children and his household after him, and they shall keep the way of the Lord to do justice and judgment, that the Lord may bring upon Abraham that which he hath spoken of him. So God says, I know this guy. He's going to command his children and his family. And it kind of reminds you of the qualifications for the ministry. He has to have his children in subjection with all gravity. It's like when God looks at a man for the ministry, he says, yeah, this is one of mine. I know him. He'll command his family. You know, so unless you're single like Paul and like me, that, you know, doesn't necessarily apply, but if they have children, you got to have them in subjection with all gravity. So this was not just a failure of David, but it was also a failure of other great men of God too. And I got a couple examples for you here. Look at some of these pillars of faith. If you go in look at 1 Samuel 3, verse 13, Eli, remember Eli was the prophet that Samuel was brought up under. And you're nodding your head. Eli was known, unfortunately, this is not something I'd want to be known for, but he was known for not disciplining his children.
Some bad boys, too.
Yeah, he sure did. Boy, fornicating with women outside the temple.
Got a little discipline problem right there.
Yeah. I mean, those are like modern-day televangelists.
Yeah.
Yeah. Filthy lucre and filthy other stuff, too. 1 Samuel 3 and verse 13. This is God speaking of Eli here. He says, "For I have told him," yeah, the Lord speaking to Samuel about Eli. Verse 13, "For I have told him that I will judge his house forever for the iniquity which he knoweth, because his sons made themselves vile, and he restrained them not." So, to him that knoweth to do good and doeth it not, to him that had sinned, Eli knew about it. He should have restrained them, and he didn't. He just allowed things to happen. Probably turned a blind eye and said, "Oh, I didn't see that." Well, yeah, God is a discerner of the thoughts and intents of the heart, and he knows when you see stuff and when you don't. So, yeah, God was going to judge his house forever. Forever. I mean, that's a long time. Forever. You think about that. I mean, let me get verse 14, and then I got a proverb I want to go to. Verse 14, "And therefore I have sworn unto the house of Eli that the iniquity of Eli's house shall not be purged with sacrifice nor offering forever." You know that verse, and just popped up in Hebrews, that reminds me, "There remaineth no more sacrifice for sin, but a fearful looking for and fiery judgment and indignation to them that sin willingly." You know, when you know what you're doing, you do it anyway. Presumptuous sins.
That's still temporal, though, in the sense of Eli right. was a child of God.
Oh yeah, 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 right. Yeah. I don't doubt that he was a child of God. But as far as the sacrifice and offering, I mean, purging, and all those were still temporal.
Yes.
You know, those sacrifices were for temporal forgiveness of sins, even back in the law. So yeah, there was going to be judgment coming to him that he was not going to be able to avert. That God, you know, the wrath of the Lord arose until there was no remedy, like it says in right there when Israel got taken off to Babylon. It was said of them that they went against his prophets. Let me see if I can find this one. I think it's in 2 Chronicles 36. Let's see. Yeah, right here we go. 2 Chronicles 36 and verse, let's just get 14 through 16 to get the whole context. "Moreover, all the chief of the priests and the people transgressed very much after all the abominations of the heathen, and polluted the house of the Lord, which he had hallowed in Jerusalem," like Eli's boys. That's exactly what they did. "And the Lord God of their fathers sent to them by his messengers, rising up betimes," which means early, "and sending because he had compassion on his people and on his dwelling place. But they mocked the messengers of God and despised his words and misused his prophets until the wrath of the Lord arose against his people till there was no remedy." He gave them a certain space. It's said there that God didn't destroy the Amorites because he said the cup of the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full. So God has a cup which he allows you to keep sinning into. And whenever that cup gets full of sin, God says, "That's it. No remedy, no going back. Now I'm going to destroy you." But he waits a while, you know, and he gives you a chance, and he gives you a chance to repent. We just don't know when that cup's going to get full. So you don't say, "Well, I don't think my cup's full yet. I'm going to keep on sinning for a while, and, you know, I probably have some time left." You might not have some time left. You never know. Good one to compare that with is in Proverbs 29. No remedy for Eli. And you know what? I mean, it makes sense, too, because men of God are held to a very high standard with God. And maybe God would have put up with, you know, just a regular old Israelite not restraining his children, but it comes to his prophet ought to have known better. Yep, the jig was up for Eli. Proverbs 29 and verse 1. He that being often reproved hardeneth his neck shall suddenly be destroyed, and that without remedy. Often reproved. Wisdom cries for a while, and then eventually that's it. No remedy. Judgment's coming, and there's nothing you're going to do about it. It's kind of like when your kids push you to the edge, and then they're getting that spanking, and there's no remedy. They're going to get it. Doesn't matter how much they try to talk you out of it. Samuel's sons didn't walk in his ways either, which you'd think Samuel, being raised by Eli, would have seen what happened to him, and he would have, you know, taken heed to that, but apparently not. 1 Samuel 8, 3 through 5. 1 Samuel 8, verses 3 through 5. Now these are the men of Israel speaking here of Samuel's children, so this was a publicly known fact that his sons weren't following in his ways. It says there in verse 3, 1 Samuel 8, "And his sons walked not in his ways, but turned aside after lucre, and took bribes, and perverted judgment. Then all the elders of Israel gathered themselves together, and came to Samuel in Ramah, and said unto him, Behold, thou art old, and thy sons walk not in thy ways. Now make us a king to judge us like the nations." So I guess they figured that his sons weren't going to be judges in his stead, in his place. So they're saying, all right, well, your kids are dope, so make us a king. And that didn't turn out so well for them either. So you see, it's interesting how Samuel, I'm assuming, didn't train up his children in the way that they should have gone. Then they are not going to be judges in his place. Then Israel clamors for a king, and then the whole nation gets judged to have a king. You know, God gave him a king in his wrath. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting how the acts of one prophet end up affecting the whole nation. Right. And, you know, here's another verse. Let's see if I can find this one. This one, if you're not paying real close attention to the grammar, you'll go right over it. I think it's in Titus. Let's see. I know where it is on the page, so I can... Yeah, right here. It is in Titus. Titus 2 and verse 7. We'll read verse 7 and 8. "In all things showing thyself a pattern of good works, and doctrine showing uncorruptness, gravity, sincerity, sound speech that cannot be condemned, that he that is of the contrary part may be ashamed, having no evil thing to say of you." Now, did anybody catch anything in there that would say that the leader's actions might have bad repercussions for the whole church?
Not be condemned?
Nope. So, look at the pronouns in verse 7. "In all things showing thyself." That's singular, right? Pattern. Look at the end of verse 8. "They may have no evil thing to say of you." Speaking of plural, like the church that he's overseeing. Isn't that interesting? So the actions, that's something that I have to take heed to. The actions of the pastor can have bad ramifications for the church. And, I mean, think about it. I go out there and get involved in some kind of a scandal, it's going to look bad for the whole church, not just for me, right? So, and for the Lord, for that matter, in the name of God be blasphemed because of my foolishness. So anyway, that's something that I have to be very careful about.
Mm-hmm. And the not raising the children, not disciplining them. Samuel grows up in a house where Eli's not disciplining children. He carries it on.
Yep.
Has ramifications for the nation. They go under slavery of a king.
Yeah.
And in America, we don't raise our children, don't discipline them, and here we are on the brink.
You bet. I mean, it all starts at home. It starts with the family. And I mean, that's the building blocks of society, you bet. Yep. And it's just a perpetual cycle, too. Then, you know, once you have if you have children that grow up in a fatherless home, and then they end up, you know, going out and not being married and you know, knocking up a bunch of women, and it just, it's a perpetuating cycle, right? And it just, you know, you end up with gangs and people in prison and everything else. Now, it's not specifically stated that Samuel didn't train up his kids correctly, but if he did, it would be the exception that they departed from it. Remember what it says in Proverbs 22:6, "Train up a child in the way that he should go, and when he's old, he shall not depart from it." So, if Samuel did train them up in the way they should have gone, then it was the exception to the rule that they didn't follow his ways. So it doesn't specifically say it, so I can't condemn Samuel for certain to say that he did not train them up right, but chances are he probably didn't, or they would have followed his ways. Like I said, Samuel should have learned from Eli's mistakes, but sometimes the apple doesn't fall too far from the tree, and that's kind of how the sins of the father get passed down, you know, and the children end up, the Lord judges to the third and fourth generation. A lot of that, I think, is just natural consequences of it. You know, your father's an alcoholic, you end up being an alcoholic, or whatever, you know, whatever the sin may be, and you end up paying for that because you pick up those bad traits. Not so much that God's saying, okay, he sinned, now I'm going to condemn you, you know, but it's more that you pick up the traits and you get condemned for your own sin.
Right.
Ministers must have their children in subjection, and that's what these guys were. Samuel and Eli were ministers. I mean, they weren't New Testament preachers per se, but I mean, the prophets at that time and the priests taught the people, so they had a very similar job. And they are supposed to, New and Old Testament, supposed to have their children trained up correctly. If you look in 1 Timothy, I'll give you a New Testament example for this. 1 Timothy 3:4-5. 1 Timothy 3:4-5. One that ruleth well his own house, having his children in subjection with all gravity. For if a man know not how to rule his own house, how shall he take care of the church of God? I mean, you think about it. I mean, if a guy, here you're considering a guy for the ministry, and he can't control his own house, and his kids are running around like idiots all the time, what makes you think somebody like that is going to be faithful with a greater responsibility of overseeing a church? You know, he that's faithful with little in the least is faithful with much. So, yeah, it would make sense that would be a good litmus test to see, you know, can he control the few little people in his realm? Is he going to be able to oversee a larger group? And I know of people, of potential ministers, of people that were being considered for the ministry, that the pastor said, no, I won't consider you for that job anymore because the guy didn't have control of his own family. And, yeah, so it happens.
Based on this verse right here.
Yeah, exactly. That was the rationale, yep. A minister's children must be faithful and not unruly in Titus 1 and verse 6. Titus 1, 6. If any be blameless, the husband of one wife, having faithful children, not accused of riot, or unruly. So, I mean, if I, as a pastor, had kids and they were unruly, I would pretty much tell them when they got to the... I mean, if they got to the age and it's going to jeopardize my calling of God and they... And I've done everything that I can, like, you guys are out. Get out. You don't want to behave yourself under my roof, then you can go elsewhere. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, this obviously, if you have 30-year-old children that have been off on their own for 10 years, this is not what this is speaking of, right? This is people that is under the control of, you know, children that would be under the control of the pastor while they're in the house. Now, Adonijah apparently wasn't the only one of David's sons whom he didn't restrain. Remember Amnon? Remember what happened with Amnon? Amnon was another one of David's sons, and he ended up raping his sister Tamar. So, yeah, what a stand-up guy. In 2 Samuel 13:10-14, I can only imagine that David probably restrained Amnon about as much as he did Adonijah, which makes sense with how Adonijah can control his passions, especially incestuous ones. It's kind of disgusting, but it was his half-sister, I think. So back in the day, I think maybe he could even marry her. I'm not sure. It sort of sounds like it. Whenever we read what his sister says to him, it kind of sounds like she would have been given to him if he would have just asked. Oh. It's kind of strange. Oh. That's what she said. So let's take a look at it. 2 Samuel 13:10-14. And Amnon said unto Tamar, that was his sister, that was Absalom's sister. Amnon and Absalom were half-brothers. Bring the meat into the chamber, that I may eat of thine hand. And Tamar took the cakes which she had made and brought them into the chamber to Amnon her brother. So backing up without reading all the details, what happened was Amnon is just lovesick for his sister Tamar, his half-sister Tamar. And he talks to, I forget what was the guy's name that he talked to. I think it was, I'm trying to look back through here. Anyway, somebody gave him advice. I think it was, Jonadab. He talked to Jonadab, And Jonadab said, all right, well, here's what you do. Lay down, pretend to be sick, tell King David, hey, can you send Tamar to bring me, to make me some food and to take care of me? So then Tamar comes in, and this is the whole plan, that he's going to try to grab her and lay with her. So she brings in to make them the cakes. So verse 11, and when she had brought them unto him for meat, he took hold of her and said unto her, come lie with me, my sister. And she answered him, nay, my brother, do not force me, for no such thing ought to be done in Israel. Do not thou this folly. And I, whither shall I cause my shame to go? And as for thee, thou shalt be as one of the fools in Israel. Now therefore, I pray thee, speak unto the king, and he will not withhold me from thee. So it kind of sounds like he would have given, which is kind of strange. I have to think about that, why the king would have given the guy's stepsister to him for a wife. But kind of strange anyway. But anyway, it says there in verse 14, howbeit he would not hearken unto her voice, but being stronger than she, forced her and lay with her. So he raped his own sister. And quite a guy there. Now when David found out about this, he was very wroth, but he didn't do anything about it. I mean, can you imagine as a father and when your son rapes your daughter and you're mad, but you don't really do anything about it? I mean, that seems kind of ridiculous to me. So we see here, you know, David's clearly had some parenting issues. 2 Samuel 13 and verse 21. But when King David heard of all these things, he was very wroth. But nothing really happened to Ammon. I mean, the law said, and I'll get into that in just a second, the law said that somebody ought to be killed for that. You know, you would be stoned for raping somebody. But, and apparently, I mean, David found out about it, so it was obviously commonly known, right? I mean, that should have been judged, and it wasn't. The law of Moses, like I said, demanded death for rape in Deuteronomy 22 and verse 25. Deuteronomy 22 and verse 25. But if a man find a betrothed damsel in the field, and the man force her and lie with her, then the man only that lay with her shall die. So the guy, as long as she screamed and she tried to get away, then he would die. If not, there was some other, there was a different law that if she didn't scream, because it wouldn't really be rape if she didn't try to get away. Yeah. But as long as she tried to get away, then yeah, I mean, he would die.
And she did that, because it says, yep, he was stronger and
sure, forced. Yep, absolutely.
The next verse says they hated her exceedingly after the event.
Yeah, isn't that something?
Hatred, yeah. That he had the love that he originally felt.
Yep.
His
yep.
Whole, wow, what a bad guy.
Yeah. Yeah, and if you, I mean, I guess I can imagine how that would happen. I mean, you're so infatuated, you love somebody so much, then you do something so reprehensible like that, and then all of a sudden, he probably realizes, I just did a terrible thing, and then you end up hating the person you did it to, because, well, if it wasn't for her, it would have never happened, you know? Mm-hmm. That's how I kind of visualize the whole thing going down.
Spoiled brat thing.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Now, a good king must judge righteously, even if it's his own family. Right, so I mean, blood shouldn't run thicker than water, and David should have taken care of business, even if it was his own son. In Proverbs 20 and verse 26, king is supposed to do judgment. It says, "A wise king scattereth the wicked and bringeth the weal over them." Well, I think Amnon would have qualified as a wicked man, and he ought to have the wheel brought over him, or hung in the gallows, or something. The pastor likewise can't show favoritism, so I always try to like to bring this back to our own present time and our own situations. Not that I'm a king, but I can't show favoritism either. In 1 Timothy 5 and verse 21, this is something that I consider a lot of the time. Anytime I have to make any kind of a decision about anything in church, I always think, okay, am I applying this consistently? You know, if I let somebody do something, you know, did I let somebody else do the same thing or whatever? You know, I always try to make sure that I'm not showing favoritism and allowing one person to do something that I wouldn't allow another person to do or whatever. 1 Timothy 5 and verse 21. I charge thee before God and the Lord Jesus Christ and the elect angels that thou observe these things without preferring one before another, doing nothing by partiality. So I can't prefer one church member above another. If I happen to be friends with one church member, I can't just, you know, let him. Jason, if we're friends, I just can't give you a pass if, you know, you did something that would have merited church judgment or something like that.
So in judgment, Jesus had John lying on his breast at the table.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Special.
Sure, you know, I know you could be closer with some church members than others without being partial to them. Yeah, I mean, the partiality would be in judgment, you know, when you're, yeah, that kind of thing. No, I'm not saying that you couldn't be closer with one church member than another.
So the fact that you let me bear and everyone else, that's okay.
That's all right, yeah.
You still have to...
Yeah, right. I just can't give you any special benefits because of that.
You can't wear the dress and long hair like you're a
yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, exactly.
Nice, Steve.
Yeah.
Nice.
Hey, don't talk to him that way. Okay. All right. Anyway. So all Christians, so it's not just me, it's you guys too. All Christians cannot show favoritism, even if it's your own children who have sinned. Look at James 2, 1 through 9. This doesn't specifically talk about children, but the fact is you can't show favoritism, period. For James 2, 1 and 9. My brethren, have not the faith of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Lord of glory, with respect of persons. That's just an old way of saying favoritism. When you're respecting persons, you're showing respect unto one person and not to another. So you can't do that. And verse 9, but if you have respect of persons, you commit sin and are convinced of the law as transgressors. And if you look at what he's talking about here, you know, he uses the example, somebody comes into your church service, into your assembly, dressed in nice clothing, and you say, hey, take this good seat. And then some poor man comes in, and you say, hey, you know, stand back there, here, sit under my footstool or something. So you're not supposed to show favoritism or respect of persons because of somebody's status, because of their wealth, because of, you know, if they're a girl or a man or whatever. I mean, none of that type of thing you should be showing favoritism to. Now, if one person in the church has a very different situation from somebody else, that might be a different story. You know, if a guy has a job where he's forced to go and miss church from time to time because he has to travel or something, and you say, well, I didn't allow so-and-so to miss church, I'm not going to allow you either. I mean, he's in a different situation, you know. So, I mean, there has to be judgment calls made there, and that wouldn't be showing respect to persons. I'm sure you can think of lots of examples if you thought about it. But getting back to that, even showing favoritism towards your own children, get a load of this verse here in Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy 13, 6 through 11. Back in Israel, if somebody came to you and said, hey, let's go follow other gods, let's go serve other gods and bow down to idols or something, it didn't matter if it was your child, your wife, your husband, your brother, anybody. You were supposed to turn them in, and they would be killed. And it would be your hand would be the first one upon them. You were not supposed to spare or pity, even if it was your own family member. Deuteronomy 13, 6 through 11. And I will make a New Testament application of this right after this. Deuteronomy 13, 6. If thy brother, the son of thy mother, or thy son, or thy daughter, or the wife of thy bosom, or thy friend, which is as thine own soul, that's like your best friend, your dear closest friend, entice thee secretly, saying, let us go and serve other gods, which thou hast not known, thou nor thy fathers, namely the gods of the people which are round about you, nigh unto you, nigh unto thee, or far off from thee, from the one end of the earth, even unto the other end of the earth. Thou shalt not consent unto him, nor hearken unto him, neither shall thine eye pity him, neither shalt thou spare, neither shalt thou conceal him. So there's no covering this thing up. This has got to come out. But thou shalt surely kill him. Thine hand shall be first upon him to put him to death, and afterwards the hand of all the people. And thou shalt stone him with stones that he die, because he hath sought to thrust thee away from the Lord thy God, which brought thee out of the land of Egypt, from the house of bondage. And all Israel shall hear and fear, and shall do no more any such wickedness as this is among you. So even if it was your closest family member or your best friend, he said, let us go serve other gods, you're to kill him, and it was going to be your hand upon him first. You were going to throw the first stone. It was the same way too when you had the rebellious son and you couldn't do anything with him. The parents throw the first stone. You think about that one. So take this into a New Testament context and think about that. What if your own children have done something, if they're church members and they've done something that merits exclusion? Guess what? Your hand better go up whenever the church vote comes to exclude them. Your hand has to be first upon them. There's no favoritism just because it's your own family. And people have had to do that, right? I mean, you guys have dealt with that, not with your own kids, but family members, where you had to vote to exclude somebody that was close to you. But, you know, water must run thicker than blood. That's a good analogy, because the spirit is likened unto water. So the water must run thicker than blood when it comes to the faith. And because of that, Absalom killed Amnon. So Absalom was Tamar's brother, Absalom was Tamar's brother and Amnon's half-brother. And, of course, he was upset about what happened, and he killed Amnon. 2 Samuel 13, 29, or 23 through 29. So Absalom couldn't do this right away. He kind of had to devise this plan of how he was going to take care of business, but he eventually got it done. And it says there, 2 Samuel 13, 23 through 29, and it came to pass after 2 full years. So Absalom had been thinking about this for a while. He'd been planning and plotting this for a while. After 2 full years that Absalom had sheep shears in Baal Hazor, which is beside Ephraim, and Absalom invited all the king's sons. And Absalom came to the king and said, "Behold, now thy servant hath sheep shears. Let the king, I beseech thee, and his servants go with thy servant." And the king said to Absalom, "Nay, my son, let us not all go now, lest we be chargeable unto thee." And he pressed him, howbeit he would not go, but blessed him. Then said Absalom, "If not, I pray thee, let my brother Amnon go with us." And the king said unto him, "Why should he go with thee?" But Absalom pressed him, and he let Amnon and all the king's son go with him. Now Absalom had commanded his servants, saying, "Mark ye now, when Amnon's heart is merry with wine, and when I say unto you, smite Amnon, then kill him. Fear not, have not I commanded you? Be courageous and be valiant." And the servants of Absalom did unto Amnon as Absalom had commanded. Then all the king's sons arose, and every man gat him up upon his mule and fled. So he has this party, gets Amnon feeling all good, and then says, "All right, kill him." And the other men kill his brother, or his half-brother. What's happening here? I mean, David doesn't restrain his children. One of his daughters gets raped, then his son gets killed, and it just gets worse and worse from here. Because of this poor parenting, two of his sons, Absalom and Adonijah, committed sedition and tried to take the kingdom from him. So not only does he have a raped daughter and a dead son, now he's got two sons that try to usurp the kingdom from him. Let's start with Absalom first. He's the one that first did it. Absalom stole the hearts of Israel and attempted to steal the kingdom from David. Absalom was a good-looking guy. I mean, he kind of had everything going for him, and you know, pride goeth before destruction and haughty spirit before a fall, and Absalom managed to get all of Israel behind him. In 2 Samuel 15, 1 through 12. And it came to pass after this that Absalom prepared him chariots and horses and 50 men to run before him. And Absalom rode up early and stood beside the way of the gate. And it was so that when any man that had a controversy came to the king for judgment, then Absalom called unto him and said, "Of what city art thou?" And he said, "Thy servant is of one of the tribes of Israel." And Absalom said unto him, "See, thy matters are good and right, but there is no man deputed of the king to hear thee." Absalom said, "Moreover, oh, that I were made judge in the land, that every man which hath any suit or cause might come unto me, and I would do him justice." See, he's playing off like, "Oh, if I were just the judge, I could judge everybody, I could take care of all this stuff. If I just had this position." And he starts to win their hearts. They think, "Oh boy, he's such a good guy. I mean, he would look out for us if he was in charge, you know, that king hasn't even deputed anybody to judge these matters, but boy, if Absalom was in charge, he'd take care of things." And it was so that when any man came nigh unto him to do him obeisance, he put forth his hand and took him and kissed him. and on this manner. So it sounds like they come to Absalom to do a bee and says, no, come here, let me give you a kiss. You know, you don't have to bow down to me. No, we're friends. You know, so he really butters people up. And on this manner did Absalom to all Israel that came to the king for judgment. So Absalom stole the hearts of the men of Israel. How far was I going to read there? Oh, down to verse 12. And it came to pass after 40 years that Absalom said unto the king, I pray thee, let me go and pay my vow, which I have vowed unto the Lord in Hebron. For thy servant vowed a vow while I abode at Geshur in Syria, saying, if the Lord shall bring me again indeed to Jerusalem, then I will serve the Lord. And the king said unto him, go in peace. So he arose and went to Hebron. But Absalom sent spies throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, as soon as ye hear the sound of the trumpet, then ye shall say, Absalom reigneth in Hebron. And with Absalom went 200 men out of Jerusalem that were called, and they went in their simplicity, and they knew not anything. See, this is kind of the nature of this whole groupthink mentality. These guys are just following Absalom, and they don't have a clue what he's doing. They just go in their simplicity. They're just following the crowd. And just like those people, whenever the silversmith of Diana, you know, creates that great, great big uproar in Ephesus, and for 2 hours they shouted, "Great is Diana, the Ephesians," and it said the more part knew not why they were come together. They got no idea. They're just following the crowd. And these people are just simpletons doing the same thing. So follow not a multitude to do evil. Just remember that. Don't follow, especially when you get in big crowds. Don't do stupid things just because other people are doing stupid things. Right. You know, don't. Yeah, exactly. And don't follow the multitude to go vote for the Republican that's running either. So, right. Yeah, don't. Anyway, or the Democrat for that matter.
Right.
So, anyway, I'm almost thinking I'm gonna do more and more what you do and just not vote anymore.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm not. I may not be totally there yet, but. I'm just like, you know what? I think just protesting the whole system might be the best thing and not going at all. What's that?
So you got 2 more years to get to
that. Yeah, I know. We'll see. I don't know. The jury's still out on that one. Verse 12. And Absalom sent for Ahithophel, the Gilonite, David's counselor, from his city, even from Gilo, while he offered sacrifices, and the conspiracy was strong, for the people increased continually with Absalom. So he made a conspiracy against his own father to take the kingdom from him, and he sweet-talked the people to get them to follow it. And you know how charismatic leaders are. I mean, Bill Clinton could probably sell sand to an Arab or ice to an Eskimo. I mean, you know, people like that can just, they can get anybody to follow them. Now, people like me, you better have some truth or something on your side, because charisma is not going to do it. So anyway, the news of Absalom was killed then because of his rebellion. I'm kind of jumping around here. I mean, I'm skipping whole chapters because, you know, we don't have 3 months to go through this whole study. I'm just kind of hitting the high points here. But anyway, Absalom ended up getting on the run, and then he ended up being killed for his rebellion, even though David didn't want him to be killed. David told the men, do not kill Absalom. David really had a special place in his heart for his kid. But anyway, Joab had other plans. In 2 Samuel 18, 9 through 15. 2 Samuel 18, 9 through 15. And Absalom met the servants of David, and Absalom rode upon a mule, and the mule went under the thick boughs of a great oak, and his head caught hold of the oak, and he was taken up between the heaven and the earth. Isn't that an interesting way of saying it? And the mule that was under him went away. So, boys, that's why you don't grow your hair out long. Grow your hair out long, gets caught in the trees, you're going to end up being hung up between the heaven and the earth and get three darts through your liver, and somebody's going to kill you. So that's the moral of the story. Don't have long hair if you don't want to die. So, anyway, I'm totally kidding. But don't have long hair because the Bible says it's a shame for a man to have long hair. That's why you don't have long hair. Anyway, where was I? Verse... yeah. Leave the poor guy alone. I'm telling you. It's if you suffer adversity for Christ's sake, Chris, just be happy and be glad. And so treated their fathers, the false prophets too. So anyway, 2 Samuel 18. Where was I? Verse 10. And a certain man saw it and told Joab and said, "Behold, I saw Absalom hanged in an oak." And Joab said unto the man that told him, And behold, thou sawest him, and why didst thou not smite him there to the ground? And I would have given thee 10 shekels of silver and a girdle. And the man said unto Joab, though I should receive 1,000 shekels of silver in mine hand, yet would not I put forth mine hand against the king's son, for in our hearing the king charged thee, and Abishai, and Ittai, saying, beware that none touch the young man Absalom. So Joab said, you know what, I'd have gave you 10 shekels of silver, you should have killed that guy. He said, you know, I don't care if you'd have gave me 100 or 1,000 shekels of silver. I'm going to keep what the king's word was and do what the king said. So this is a faithful guy to the king right there. Even if the king was wrong, he was still following the king's order. Mm-hmm. Verse 13. Otherwise, I should have wrought falsehood against mine own life, for there is no matter hid from the king, and thou thyself wouldest have set thyself against me.
Wow, smart.
Yeah, exactly. Isn't that something?
Turn the man after
him. Yep, you bet. That's right. Don't ever do anything for a wicked man when he promises to pay you something. Like right. Judas, you know. Judas went and the high priest gave him 30 pieces of silver. After he realizes he did the wrong thing, he goes back and gives the money back, and they say, what is that to thee? Have thou to it. You know, hey, we don't care.
What's that?
You know, we got what we wanted. I don't know if that's exactly. They said something like that anyway. Yeah. It was close anyway.
Not gonna pay me, yeah.
Yeah. What did they say? What is that to, what is that to us? See thou to it. See thou to it, I think is what they said. Yeah, it was something like that anyway. So, no comments from the peanut gallery. So anyway, yeah, don't ever do something for a wicked person that promises you something in return. Verse 14, then said Joab, I may not tarry thus with thee. And he took 3 darts in his hand and thrust them through the heart of Absalom while he was yet alive in the midst of the oak. And 10 young men that bare Joab's armor compassed about and smote Absalom and slew him. So Absalom ended up being killed for his rebellion eventually, even though his own dad didn't want him to be. Now once again, David was putting his rebellious children before justice and his duty as king, for which Joab rebuked him. See, once again, with Amnon, I mean, justice should have prevailed there. Amnon should have been put to death for raping his sister. David didn't do anything. Absalom commits sedition against the king. He should have been put to death. David wasn't going to do anything about that. So Joab finally had enough and thought, you know what, I'm going to do what David should have done, even if David said not to do it. And interestingly, Joab rebuked him for it. In 2 Samuel 19, 5 through 8, and Joab came to the house. So somebody came to David, mourned. I don't think I have this in here. When David found out about it, let me just back up just quickly. In 2 Samuel 18, 33, and yeah, just 33. And the king was much moved and went up to the chamber over the gate and wept as he went. Thus he said, O my son Absalom, my son Absalom. Would God I had died for thee, O Absalom, my son. Now, I thought I had that. I wonder if I somehow deleted something out of here. Oh, no. No. I skipped a point. I knew. I thought I skipped it. Yeah. I meant to get verse 31. Let me get verse 31 and 32. Yeah, that the news of Absalom's death broke David's heart. And behold, Cushai came, and Cushai said, tidings, my lord, the king, for the Lord hath avenged thee this day of all them that rose up against thee. And the king said unto Cushai, is the young man Absalom safe? And Cushai said, the enemies of my lord the king and all that rise against thee to do thee hurt be as the young man is. In other words, Absalom's dead with all of the rest of them. And that's when David starts lamenting the death of Absalom, his son. And I'm sure as a father you can understand that that would be a terrible thing. And you just wonder, and I think you mentioned this the other day or a month ago or whatever, and I think you're probably right. The reason why David probably mourned so much was because he probably realized that he didn't restrain the kid like he should have, and it was ultimately his fault that the kid went off and ended up being a rebel and then ended up dying. And I'm sure David probably took some of that responsibility to himself, you know, because he probably thought, you know, if I would have just done the right thing, if I would have trained him up right, if I would have done this, he wouldn't have ended up dead. And now he's dead and it's my fault, you know. Whether it was actually his fault or not, I can imagine a lot of times people rationalize things like that. You know, when that type of thing happens, you always think it's your fault. Yeah. Yeah.
I don't think I said it, though.
You did say it, as a matter of fact. Right there at that table, yeah. So give credit where credit's due. That's yeah.
I was actually going to give it to Steve.
Yeah. No. No, that was a good point. So, yeah, I would think so anyway. I mean, I would tend to think I as a rebel who deserved it, but easy for me to say, right? I mean, it wasn't my son. So, but anyway, once again, David was putting his rebellious children before justice. And it's interesting that how other men, though, in the scriptures reacted when their sons that did something wrong were killed. And they reacted quite differently than David did. You remember Nadab and Abihu, Aaron's sons, the priests? In Leviticus 10, Nadab and Abihu offered strange fire before the Lord, mm-hmm. and the Lord, as I said, fired them, right? Fire came down and killed them. Mm-hmm. Well, whenever it was said of Aaron that Aaron held his peace whenever that happened. And you can imagine, I mean, Aaron was not very happy with God, like, you know, what's going on here, God? They offer strange fire, whatever that was, didn't do it by the book, and God strikes him dead. But it said Aaron held his peace. And I think it was Eli also. Eli said the same thing, that he said, it is the Lord, let him do as he pleases. I forget exactly how he said it. But the same thing, whenever that judgment came down to Eli, that his sin wasn't going to be purged by sacrifice, like we just read there earlier, mm-hmm. and that his sons were going to be judged, Eli didn't say, oh, my son, you know, and started. He said, it is the Lord, you know, do what you will, basically. And so quite a different response than David had. Mm-hmm. So anyway, whatever that's worth. So 2 Samuel 19, 5 through 8. So Joab ends up rebuking David, and I think he was right. 2 Samuel 19, 8, 5 through 8. And Joab came into the house to the king and said, thou hast shamed this day the faces of all thy servants, which this day have saved thy life and the lives of thy sons and of thy daughters, and the lives of thy wives, and the lives of thy concubines. So you can imagine what this, I mean, here you have this rebel coming after the king. They finally kill the guy and save the kingdom and save David and his whole family. And instead of thanking the men that saved his family, he's weeping over the rebel son Absalom. And you can imagine how that would look to the kingdom. So I think Joab's absolutely right. In that thou lovest thine enemies and hatest thy friends, for thou hast declared this day that thou regardest neither princes nor servants. For this day I perceive that if Absalom had lived and all we had died this day, then it had pleased thee well. Now therefore arise, go forth, and speak comfortably unto thy servants. For I swear by the Lord, if thou go not forth, there will not tarry one with thee this night, and that will be worse unto thee than to thee than all the evil that befell thee from thy youth until now. Then the king arose and set up and sat in the gate, and they told unto him unto all the people, saying, behold, the king doth sit in the gate. And all the people came before the king, and Israel had for Israel had fled every man to his tent. So anyway, David kind of gets his emotions under control and does what Joab says. And he was probably wise for doing it, because it'd be bad enough to lose your son and then lose the entire kingdom too, because everybody, you know, thinks that you're showing partiality to your kid and you're in such a distraught condition you can't even rule the kingdom anymore. So David's deep sorrow for the loss of his son could very well, and I already mentioned that, I got ahead of myself. Yeah, it was probably for the responsibility that he felt for Absalom's rebellion. The death of children can be the result of poor parenting and the consequential rebellion of children. Proverbs 30, verse 17. This is a sobering passage if you understand what it's talking about. I never did until I heard it in a sermon used one day for this same type of point, and I thought, oh, that's what that's talking about. Proverbs 30 and verse 17. See if you ever thought about this one this way. The eye that mocketh at his father and despiseth to obey his mother, the ravens of the valley shall pick it out. The ravens of the valley are going to pick out the eye of the person that mocks his father and despises his mother because the kid's dead. That's the eyes that ravens pick out.
That's right.
Yeah, vultures and that kind of thing, you know, they pick at dead things. Yeah, mm-hmm. So that can cause, there can be severe consequences for mocking your father and despising your mother. How many children, just think about it, how many children have died due to drug use, drunk driving, gang violence, AIDS, because their parents failed to train them up properly and restrain them. They didn't do anything with them, and they end up being out of control kids, you know, and then look at the consequences that happen. You know, it'd be a terrible thing. I mean, it'd be absolutely awful. Now, Adonijah, one of David's other sons, don't touch it, one of David's other sons tried to usurp the kingdom from him at the end of his life. So poor David, I don't know if I can say poor David, but it was just basically from the time that he had that affair with Bathsheba and forward, his whole life was just pretty much one misery after another. Just what, you know, Absalom tries to take the kingdom, he's on the run from his own son, and then, you know, his other son rapes his daughter before that, and then his other son Adonijah then tries to take the kingdom, right? Is David's literally on his deathbed, mm-hmm. and Adonijah tries to take the kingdom from him. Mm-hmm. I mean, just
the sword that was...
Yeah, it said that the sword would never depart from his house.
Yeah.
Yep. Because he killed Uriah the Hittite. Yep. He said because of that the sword would never depart from his house. And yeah, boy, you talk about lifelong consequences.
Still cutting it up to the end.
Yep. Yeah, literally, he's on his deathbed. He literally was, and it was still happening. 1 Kings 1 and verse 5. 1 Kings 1 and verse 5.
They had interesting medical treatments for old people back then.
They did, yeah. don't get any ideas.
Now that, Obamacare pays for that.
Yeah, yeah. I'm really cold and shivery. I need some treatment. Yeah. 1 Kings 1:5. Actually, just for the fun of it, let's read 1 through 5 now that you talk about that. Now King David was old and stricken in years, and they covered him with clothes, but he got no heat. Now, this says he was old and well stricken in years. It says in another place he was full of days. He was 70 years old. Don't anybody tell Bud. Okay. old and stricken in years. Yeah, I know. Verse 2. Wherefore his servants said unto him, let there be sought for my lord the king a young virgin, and let her stand before the king, and let her cherish him, and let her lie in his bosom, that my lord the king may get heat. Yeah. 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 I don't know what his other wives would have thought of this, but he had plenty of them. But so, yeah, interesting way to get heat. And it says when two lie together, they get, you know, they have heat, Solomon said. So,
two are stronger than
that. Yeah. I'm not even going to go any further than that. So, verse 3. So they sought for a fair damsel throughout all the coast of Israel and found Abishag. Interesting name. Okay, anyway. Abishag, the Shunammite, and brought her to the king. And the damsel was very fair and cherished the king and ministered to him, but the king knew her not. So apparently David was definitely up there in years, and they didn't have Viagra and things back in those days. So, anyway, now here's what I was going to talk about. Verse 5, then Adonijah, the son of Haggith, exalted himself, saying, I will be king. And he prepared him chariots and horsemen and 50 men to run before him. So here David is on his deathbed, and Adonijah is going to try to usurp the kingdom from him. And look at verse 6, and here's probably why this happened. And his father had not displeased him at any time, saying, why hast thou done so? And he also was a very goodly man, and his mother bare him after Absalom. So David didn't restrain him, and he ends up, at the end of his life, it comes back in spades, and he tries to take the kingdom from him. Now David was able to install Solomon on the throne before he died. It's kind of an interesting, I'm not going to read the whole thing, but it is interesting how the whole thing panned out. But I believe it was Bathsheba found out about it and then came and told David, and then she said, hey, didn't you say that Solomon was going to be the king? And because David didn't have any idea what was going on. You know, they didn't have Facebook back then and everything. You didn't see, you know, Absalom or Adonijah wasn't posting on there, you know, I'm taking the kingdom now or something, right, you know. And... So let's see, 1 Kings 1:28-39. So this is Bathsheba came to David and asked him if he wasn't gonna, you know, if Solomon wasn't supposed to take the throne. Then King David answered and said, "Call me Bathsheba," and she came into the king's presence and stood before the king, and the king swore and said, "As the Lord liveth, that hath redeemed my soul out of all distress, even as I swear unto thee by the Lord God of Israel, saying, Assuredly Solomon thy son shall reign after me, and he shall sit upon my throne in my stead, even so will I certainly do this day." Then Bathsheba bowed with her face to the earth and did reverence to the king and said, "Let my lord King David live forever." And King David said, "Call me Zadok the priest, and Nathan the prophet, and Benaiah the son of Jehoiada." And they came before the king. And the king said, the king also said unto them, "Take with you the servants of your lord, and cause Solomon my son to ride upon mine own mule, and bring him down to Gihon. And let Zadok the priest and Nathan the prophet anoint him there king over Israel, and blow ye with the trumpet, and say, God save King Solomon." And I'm going to read down through verse, 39. Yeah. "Then ye shall come up after him, that he may come and sit upon my throne, for he shall be king in my stead, and I have appointed him to be ruler over Israel and over Judah. And Benaiah the son of Jehoiada answered the king and said, Amen, the Lord God of my Lord the king, say so too. As the Lord hath been with my Lord the king, even so be he with Solomon, and make his throne greater than the throne of my Lord King David. So Zadok the priest and Nathan the prophet and Benaiah the son of Jehoiada and the Kerethites and the Pelethites went down and caused Solomon to ride upon King David's mule, and brought him to Gihon, and Zadok the priest took an horn of oil out of the tabernacle and anointed Solomon, and they blew the trumpet, and all the people said, God save King Solomon. So it happened before David's death. He did get accomplished what he said was going to happen, and Solomon became king. And though Solomon spared Adonijah for a while, he was eventually killed too, because Adonijah went and grabbed the horns of the altar and pleaded for mercy. And Solomon said, all right, you know, I'll let you live. But it didn't last too long. Adonijah wanted Abishag for his own wife. And so he tried to talk Bathsheba, his mother, into getting Abishag for his wife. When Solomon found out about this, then that was the last straw. And Solomon took care of him in 1 Kings 2:21 through 25. 1 Kings 2:21-25. And she said, this is Bathsheba going back to Solomon now, her son. And she said, "Let Abishag the Shunammite be given to Adonijah thy brother to wife." And King Solomon answered and said unto his mother, "Why dost thou ask Abishag the Shunammite for Adonijah? Ask for him the kingdom also? For he is mine elder brother, even for him, and for Abiathar the priest, and for Joab, the son of Zeruiah." Then King Solomon swore by the Lord, saying, "God do so to me, and more also, if Adonijah have not spoken this word against his own life." So death and life are in the power of the tongue, it says in Proverbs. And a fool's mouth gets him into lots of trouble. "Now therefore, as the Lord liveth, which hath established me and set me on the throne of David my father, and who hath made me an house as he promised, Adonijah shall be put to death this day." And King Solomon sent by the hand of Benaiah the son of Jehoiada, and he fell upon him that he died. So Adonijah got what was coming to him too. Just took a little while. Sometimes payday doesn't come on every Friday, but it comes eventually. Now, three of David's sons were killed because of their wickedness. which could all reasonably be traced back to David's poor fathering of him. So that's a pretty bad track record, especially for a man after God's own heart. Just shows you that Christians are not exempt from this kind of thing, right? It can even happen to us. And as we started off the study, I'll go back and read these verses, that the things that happened aforetime were written for our learning, that we, through patient comfort of the Scriptures, might have hope. I think I got that one pretty well. That's Romans 15, verse 4. Let me see if I got it. I probably want to quote it right. I read this book by Spurgeon called Lectures to My Students, and in there he talked about quoting Scripture, and he said, and it kind of really brought me under conviction, he said, you know, if you're going to quote it, you better quote it word for word, verbatim, and get it right, and not just guess at it. And he's like, if you can't get it, don't quote it by memory, you know, go read it. And I thought, you know, there's something to that, and sometimes you just, you know, you just try to generally say what it says, and you might not get it perfectly, and I don't think God's going to hold you to, you know, you're not intentionally maligning the Word of God, you're just trying to tell people what it says, though you might not be able to remember it right perfectly. But if you can quote it, it's probably a better idea to do so. Romans 15, verse 4, "For whatsoever things were written aforetime were written for our learning, that we through patience and comfort of the Scriptures might have hope." So those things back there that we've been reading about David were written for our learning, that we through patient comfort of the Scriptures might have hope. So you look at the good things that David did, and we can get patient, we can get comfort and patience from that, and get hope from that. The, you know, how David was courageous and going and fighting the enemies of the Lord and all that kind of thing, and being a man after God's heart, God's own heart. But on the other side of it, these things were also written for our admonition. 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 11. Paul says, "Now all these things happen unto them for ensamples." That was Israel in the wilderness when they died in the wilderness because of their unbelief. That's what he's talking about here in context. "And they are written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the world are come." So they're written for us to give us patience, to give us comfort and hope, but they're also written as admonitions to tell us to be careful. Don't do the same things that these guys did. So though David was a man after God's own heart, and he was abundantly blessed by God, he also suffered a lot of pain and sorrow for the poor decisions he made. Though David never lost eternal blessings from God, he lost a lot of temporal ones. And boy, there's a verse here that I love this verse for many reasons, though it's kind of a sad verse, but yet it still shows God's sovereign grace and salvation, that even when we screw up, yet God is still faithful. So it's a comforting verse and kind of a scary and sad verse at the same time. And I should probably give it to you. It's 2 Samuel 23 and verse 5. Instead of, I'm looking at it, turning to it, and then I'm not telling you. 2 Samuel 23 and verse 5. David reflected back here, and he says, "Although my house be not so with God, yet he hath made with me an everlasting covenant, ordered in all things and sure. For this is all my salvation and all my desire, although he make it not to grow." Boy, isn't that something? God had made with David an everlasting covenant, ordered in all things and sure. Nothing was going to change that covenant. God had made not only just a covenant to save David's soul, he'd made him a covenant that Christ was going to come through him. Right. And all these promises to David, it's as sure can be. God said it, it's going to happen. I read a Matthew Henry quote the other day when he said, "With God, saying and doing are not two different things." And I thought, boy, isn't that good? Saying and doing are not two different things with God. But anyway, that covenant was as sure as can be. That was all David's salvation and his desire, although he make it not to grow. There you have a man eternally saved and given many, many eternal blessings, but yet in his life, God didn't make it to grow. He suffered temporal judgments, even though he was a child of God. So I'll leave you back there in 1 Corinthians 10 with the next verse in verse 12, after the one we just read a minute ago. "These things are written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the world are come. Wherefore, let him that thinketh he standeth take heed lest he fall." Because if it happened to them, it can happen to us. I mean, who are we kidding ourselves? We don't think that we couldn't make the same mistakes that David made and that all the Old Testament saints made. So anyway, I hope you've got a good blessing from this and learn both from David's strengths and from his shortcomings. And God bless you, and I'll see you in a couple weeks for another study.
Thank you.